everyone will remember the massive fish that happened at Menindee. And it's an acute example of what's happening across the whole river system, which is that too much water is being taken from the river. But what that looks like along the Murray and what it looks like elsewhere is really just the loss of the smaller and medium-sized flows that are essential for sustaining most of the floodplain, as well as the sort of connectivity that you need to have between a floodplain and a river that really separates a river that's able to live as a river from a river that's just treated as a channel to deliver water for irrigation. And so the ministers met on Friday last week to discuss the implementation of the Murray-Darling Basin Plan. And at the heart of that is really, how can we set aside enough water to bring back some of those small and medium-sized flows to sustain the floodplain and to sustain the whole length of the river system?
So we've been told that, pointed out by Environment Victoria and the other environmental organisations with skin in this game in the other states that are involved, that New South Wales and Victoria in particular are being recalcitrant. And in fact, the National Water Minister in New South Wales is actually accused of gaslighting and sidestepping. These are so that that the Murray Basin plan for increased water flows don't happen in June 2024. Can you tell us why the Victorian and New South Wales water ministers in particular are behaving like this?
At the start of the basin plan, really, we can look back to the Water Act in 2007, which acknowledged in law that too much water and we need to take less. And so the question of how much was meant to be a question left to the best available science. In 2010, as they were starting to do the preparation for the basin plan, a figure came out of 7,600 gigaliters was what you needed to have a good chance of the river system survival. And that's not restoring everything to some imagined pristine state. That's maintaining the basic ecological functions that are characteristic of the river system. So 7,600 gigaliters was the figure they came up with, and 500-ish gigaliters is about a Sydney harbor. From the start, Victoria and Wales weren't happy with that amount and made the target a question of political expediency rather than best available science. So eventually it got whittled down to closer to 2750, so less than half of what the best available science needed. And South Australia was able to push for a bit more to guarantee the health of the Coorong. Really important wetlands internationally that are at the bottom of the river system. Where we're at now is about 2,100 gigaliters have been recovered. So we're working up towards a target that's good for keeping the river system alive, but not nearly what we need to guarantee its survival. But Victoria and New South Wales are basically saying that we're about done and that the only projects left that they're really interested in doing are part of an offset scheme, a scheme that was invented to get paper water instead of the real thing, that basically offsets the responsibility to return water to rivers. And so that's where we're at now, is the federal government saying, let's get on with the job, let's start returning water to rivers. South Australia is pushing for it, but the Victorian New South Wales government are basically saying, look, the only thing really we're interested in doing at this point is advancing our offset scheme. So it's really a question of who wants more water for rivers at this point, and whether it's going to be paper water or whether it's going to be the real thing.
So what does Victoria and New South Wales want the water for?
When we talk about setting water aside for rivers, it's a question of, right now we know the system's over-allocated. There's a lot of water for consumptive use and for irrigators. And the question is, can we buy some of that water back? So pay irrigators to take a bit less. Most of the time, irrigators usually stay in farming, just sell a bit of their share, and use that money to invest in other parts of the business, whether that's paying down debt or whether it's converting to more dry land production, or really anything that makes the business more resilient in a hotter, drier climate. And so that's what we're seeing right now, really, is this question of should we buy back water, or is allowing the over extraction, over allocation to go on to the detriment of the river system, an appropriate subsidy, I suppose, for keeping water prices temporarily low, but not even all that significant for irrigators in the short term.
When we're talking about irrigators, are we talking about farmers? Are we talking about crop farmers?
It's a range of what's being grown. There's dairy, there's stone fruit, there's a lot of folks have heard about almonds and cotton in different parts of the basin. And the main argument, I suppose, that's being leveraged against setting enough water aside that the river can survive is this idea that it'll increase water prices. So this notion that if you have a lower supply in the consumptive pool, it'll push prices up. Of course, we know that there's a lot of other drivers of change and a lot of other drivers that are really the things that are making farmers leave the industry. For the most part, research has found that it's climate change and that it's the massive impact that climate change is having on water prices. And then there's all the other sort of business factors with consolidation driven by larger corporations.
What larger corporations?
There's a range, I guess, of large corporate players when you talk about any commodity. So larger players in cotton, larger players in nuts and permanent horticulture. And so if we're thinking about water prices, for example, there's been massive changes just by the large amount of permanent plantings, which need water every year to sustain those trees. And that has a big impact on the demand side of water prices.
The reason why I bring these issues up is because here is the balance that certain businesses are being prioritized over the actual natural environment that makes it possible for everything to continue.
Yeah, I think that we're at a point now where it's clear that regional communities and sustaining a good range of diverse jobs, but also a diverse range of food and fiber production. So not just large businesses that can pay more for water in a hotter, drier climate, but also, smaller family farms. We need really intentional policy to think about how we address the full range of challenges that's being faced in agriculture. And I think that starts with accepting that taking too much water from the river system isn't an option. It's not an appropriate policy response to address that myriad of complex challenges being faced. But at the same time, it's still essential to address them.
So, out of the meeting last Friday, you were saying that there hasn't been much movement, but environment organisations are calling for the Federal Minister Plibersek to stand up to New South Wales and Victoria by purchasing water as the only cost-effective, practical way to return water to the river. That's correct, isn't it?
That's right. So there's a few ways to set water aside for the river. Buybacks or water purchases, which is just paying farmers for a share of their water rights, is really the most cost-effective and direct option. There have been a few other things tried in the past, like off-farm efficiency projects, which are lining leaky channels to try and save a bit of water that was otherwise evaporating or seeping into the ground. But there aren't too many of those projects left, and they're really poor value for money. And then the last option is on-farm efficiency projects. So improvements to water infrastructure on-farm. But those end up being, on average, 3 to 25 times more expensive than just purchasing the water. And there haven't ever been any studies to really check that there's the same changes in stream flow to guarantee that those savings are being achieved. So The federal government's move to return to water purchases, which is where the bulk of water that's been set aside for the river system has come from, is really just a common sense move to get on with the job of the basin plan. It's the best value for money, and it's the most effective way to save water for the river.
It's interesting, isn't it, that the rivers themselves are so important, and the Australian continent is so dry that it seems unimaginable that you wouldn't make policy with the rivers as the main game rather than just the things that hang off the rivers. It's interesting, isn't it?
But I think the Water Act, which the Basin Plan rests upon, is really some impressive legislation that it says it's an environment first act. It says we need to make sure there's enough water for the river to survive, and we'll build everything off that basis. It was never meant to be this process where we weigh economic gains against the death of a river system. It was always supposed to be, let's set enough water aside for the river and then go from there. So I think the intention behind it is still good, but it's just a shame that really the Victorian government, in partnership and lockstep with Barnaby Joyce and the New South Wales Nationals, has turned it into a political question.
A lot of people think that the Nationals represent the farming community, but really, that's they're not representing small farmers. They're actually representing corporate interests. So.
It's interesting. I think you look at some of the ways that when we talk about the resistance to just straightforward water purchases, the alternative has been these on-farm efficiency projects, which are just really large handouts
Yeah.
for on-farm irrigation infrastructure. And by and large, if you're a small family farm, you're more than 20 times less likely to receive money for one of those projects than a large corporate enterprise. And at the same time, we're seeing big changes about who's in the water market, who's buying water, how they're driving up the price of water, and how much they're prepared to pay. That this notion that we can just stand back and not get on with the job of the basin plan, it's not going to do much good for confronting those real drivers, those real pressures. That farmers of a range of different sizes are facing, which are things like climate change and risk profile and commodity prices that are really challenging.
Well, it's also interesting to me that the river is so long that it goes through all the different states. And of course, South Australia with the Coorong is at the end of it, of the flow. But I on investigation of this whole issue before, I was really struck by the focus of those corporate interests and to the point, the revelation that they were sequestering water. Like taking runoff, and they had enough funds to be able to create infrastructure that allowed them to keep the runoff water.
Yeah, so this is a practice in the Northern Basin. So all the northern part of the river system above Menindee, called floodplain harvesting. You don't see it as much in the south, but in the north you have these big landscapes that are relatively flat. So you just need to build a small levee or raise a road to be able to capture what's a lot of water. And so right now what's happening in New South Wales is there's been this ongoing process and question of how do you license and begin accounting for all of these operations that have set up and taken water in the excess of the cap on water take that was set up in the 90s. And what's essentially happening now is these licenses are being given out with very strange provisions on them that not only permit water take in excess of what was supposed to be a cap set decades ago, but with this provision that they're calling carryover, which is unethical in some ways, in that it allows this debt to be taken from the river system. So we know that the rivers in the Northern Basin are really variable. You have some years that are really wet, some years that are really dry. And so what's happening is these licenses have a 500% or a 300% carryover provision. So if it's a dry year and you're not able to take all your allocation, it then gets carried into the next year. And so if there's a series of consecutive dry years, it might be that a big flow finally does come, but you've accumulated so much quote unquote debt from the river to you that you're able to finally take an abundance of those flows when they do come, when they should be restoring the plant, when they should be flowing down to Menindee, flowing down into the Coorong. So it's really dodgy, and it goes against the whole principle of the Basin Plan, which is why it's such a hot issue in New South Wales.
Yeah, right. Okay. And so you and other organisations, the Conservation Council of South Australia, New South Wales Nature Council, Conservation Council, and Queensland Conservation Council with the Environ Victoria are raising awareness. And what would you like the public to be aware of? What do you want them to do?
So for listeners in Victoria, I think it's really important for us to be holding our government to account. I think it's been just as bad of an actor and really giving cover to, folks like Barnaby Joyce, who get a lot of the blame for the plan, but Victoria's really in lockstep asking for a lot of the same things. Now we're at a point where the federal government's moving. They're saying, let's start this purchasing this water. Let's make sure we reach these really basic water targets that have been set for the deadlines coming up in 2024. And so over the next few months and the next year or so, we need to be holding the government to account, making sure that they get on with the job. That includes not postponing the targets for the sake of these dodgy offset projects. We just need to get real water for the rivers.